On this episode of the Vegan Chub Club podcast, we discuss health at every size, intuitive eating, and self-care in quarantine. Join us as we learn all about body liberation and body autonomy with a registered dietitian who's put a big stamp on the anti-diet culture. Do you love the Vegan Chub Club and want to see us grow? Share us with your chubby vegan friends. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcast, and if you like an episode, leave a review. Be sure to stay tuned until the end of this episode so that you can hear a special collaboration announcement. Let's jump in. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Vegan Chub Club. I'm your host, Miranda. As you know, the Vegan Chub Club is all about breaking the stereotypes surrounding veganism and larger bodies, which is why I'm super excited for our guest today. We have with us Taylor Wolfram, an ethical vegan dietitian who is weight-inclusive, anti-diet, intersectional, and preaches body liberation for all. Taylor, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Miranda. Thank you so much. I'm so excited and honored to be here.
We are so excited to have you. You are a huge name in the community for veganism and anti-diet culture. I'm just so excited to have you here too.
Oh, yay!
You're in Chicago, right?
Yep, I am, and the sun is shining today. It's been gloomy and rainy all week, so I'm really excited.
Yes, we have a little bit of sunshine here in Denver. We're actually known for having, like, I forget how many, it's like 300 days of sunshine a year. So, like, we rarely have a cloudy day.
That's amazing.
Yes. So, you mentioned that you love talking about body liberation and body autonomy as the link between veganism and health at every size and fat acceptance. To people who may not know very much about that, that's a lot of important words. And I would love if you wanted to break that down for us.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Thank you. After studying all of these seemingly siloed, like, social justice causes, I've really been able to, like, sit back and see, like, hey, these are way more similar than they look and way more similar than maybe people in each camp may realize. And for me, kind of, you know, having a foot in, like, the radical space in terms of fat acceptance and the radical space in terms of, like, veganism and animal rights, I'm kind of able to see how they overlap. And so for me, like you said, I see it as, like, body autonomy and body liberation, which really just means having the right to do what you want with your body, like being free, having the right to do, you know, whatever you want with your body, which, mm-hmm. you know, for humans, a lot of us probably immediately think of, like, feminism and reproductive rights. Obviously, within the sphere of fat acceptance, having the right to enjoy life in whatever size body you have and pursue health if you want or not, and live life by your values. And then on the vegan side, of course, you know, not exploiting, harming, killing animals is kind of where I see it. And so health at every size is, it's a paradigm. It has five principles based on size acceptance, yes, but also supporting folks to get healthcare that they want in an equitable manner and engaging in meaningful self-care. It's also pretty intersectional. It's been updated over the years to include, you know, non-discrimination for lots of other forms of identity. And so it was created by a group called ASDA is the acronym. It's A-S-D-A-H. It's the Association for Size, Diversity, and Health. And so that's really, like, the mothership for at least kind of, like, the academic and clinical side of fat acceptance and how it pertains to physical and mental health care. So I'm a registered dietitian, so I'm involved in that space. And then I'm personally an ethical vegan and also help folks who are vegan with their nutrition. So that's kind of why I'm swimming in both of these, you know, kind of oceans at the same time. And it's been really cool to see the overlap and to also help other people on each side see that overlap as well, because I'm sure you're very familiar with, you know, it is tough sometimes when folks on one side don't quite understand the other side.
Mm-hmm. And, like, that kind of leads into my next question, which is, a lot of people seem to say that when they announce that they're vegan to whomever, they'll occasionally hear, oh, but I thought vegans were skinny. Is there any kind of advice you could give to plus size, chubby, or fat vegans who are hearing that? Is there a choice response that can, for lack of a better phrase, just shut people up about that?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. And yeah, I've heard that all the time. I've even heard it said to me, and I'm a straight size person, you know. Wow. Maybe you could say like on the higher end of straight size. I'm not considered like plus size, or, and I don't identify as a fat person or have that lived experience. And even I get that. And it's like, okay, come on.
Wow.
Like, chill. Why are we talking about bodies at all? Mm-hmm. So I really think it depends on who it is and what your relationship is like with them and how comfortable you feel, because of course, like, protecting yourself is the number one priority. I think just an easy kind of quick comeback, which can be done in a totally, you know, compassionate way, maybe a little sassy if you want, is just saying like, nope, we come in all shapes and sizes, just like everyone else, mm-hmm. you know, and just kind of nip it in the bud and kind of just make it clear like, yep, body diversity is totally normal. And food is like one very, very tiny part that might determine your body size.
Yes, and food is just one part of veganism too, a vegan lifestyle.
Yep, absolutely. That is a concept I talk about a lot as well, kind of straddling these two spaces and dealing with kind of like the plant-based crowd in the vegan area who might seem very like anti fat acceptance and carry a lot of weight stigma and healthism. And then on the other side, they're definitely in the eating disorders field, which is where a lot of the fat positive dietitians work. A lot of them see people using vegan eating with their eating disorder, and so they assume that it's a diet or it's just about food and don't understand that it's an ethical lifestyle. But of course, with the population they're working with, it can be really tricky and people can be, you know, misusing it.
And I mean, like you're saying, going back to how to respond to people when it feels like you're seemingly attacked, I mean, I think a lot of it, you know, just boils down to knowing why you're rooted in that. And I think a lot of it can boil down to the confidence that you portray as well. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think so. Although I don't want folks to think like, oh, I just need to be more confident and that will erase other people's weight stigma, because right. That's on them. It's not on you. Like, you don't have to do anything, you know, like it's like on the bigots to deal with their bigotry. Like, it's not on you. But I do totally get where you're coming from in terms of like kind of how you carry yourself and how you act in situations with or without vegan food and all that kind of stuff. It's so interesting how some people's family or friends can be a little antagonizing sometimes.
Right. And that, of course, just, I guess, goes back to what kind of relationship you have with that person. Again, like, if it's a toxic relationship with a family member, you knowing who you are will not always resonate with them and their want to shake you or break you, or et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, it's really tricky.
I do think that it is helpful, because there are a lot of people who are unknowingly fat phobic or carry weight stigma and say comments like that, maybe even well-meaning, and like literally don't understand or like don't see a problem with what they said. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if you do have the energy to do so, to maybe do a little education with those people about like why saying things like that aren't appropriate and why they can be really harmful. Just like complimenting any sort of apparent weight loss can be really harmful, right? And no one should ever say anything like that. And so it really just depends on your relationship and then also, you know, what you feel comfortable and safe doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And even people who you're close to may not know if you are struggling with an eating disorder and will say things to you that can be very harmful. So education sounds like a great way to start your activism for helping yourself be accepted mm-hmm. and for the community. And I know you're a registered dietitian. Do you want to go back and maybe tell us about how you became vegan and maybe how you got on the path to being an RD?
Sure, yeah. Those paths were kind of intertwined for me. They happened around the same time in life for me in my undergraduate experience in college. Well, I should go way back. Like, I was born and raised Midwest, typical meat and potatoes, meat eater kind of family, like loved cats and dogs, had pets my whole life, but also, you know, ate meat and dairy and eggs like most of us, right? A lot of us aren't born ethical vegans. And so for me, it was my freshman year of college that I just started kind of like not liking meat anymore, like the taste of it, just found that I wasn't really attracted to it. And, you know, having a dining hall with like all these yummy options and lots of, you know, vegetarian and vegan options, it was really easy for me to just like eat other things that didn't contain meat. And so I think that kind of sparked my curiosity. I was like, oh, like, does that mean I'm a vegetarian now? Like, what does that even mean? And, you know, started to do some Googling and some searching, and through that just learned a little bit more about animal agriculture and animal rights in general. And so I got curious about those topics and started going to meetings at my university's animal rights club. And it was through that club, and then the city that my university was in also had an animal rights organization that did a lot of, you know, on the ground activism. I got involved with them too. Through that, I learned a ton. And then was like, okay, you know, I have to go vegan. I can't support these industries anymore. Like, that light bulb went off of like, yeah, there's no difference between a puppy and a calf or a chicken and a cat and those sorts of things. So it was very ethically motivated for me in the beginning. And I was definitely one of those, you know, headstrong, passionate vegan activists who probably posted lots of super annoying things on Facebook. And so that was all going on when I was in college. And so I had started college as a pre-med major, thinking, oh, I'm going to be a doctor. And after, you know, working in some labs and shadowing some physicians and learning just more about the medical field, I decided that wasn't really for me, and that I was really passionate about food and I liked nutrition, and I had taken some nutrition classes, and I was like, okay, well, you know, being a registered dietitian, you still get to work with patients and clients, but you have a lot more time with them. Like, you can spend an hour in session with them and really learn about them, engage with them, help them with, you know, actual like behavior changes that they want to make, and do more counseling rather than, you know, doctors are in and out of the room and it's all about medications and surgery and, you know, just Western medicine. And so I was like, okay, I'll pursue that. And so that transition happened at the same time that I was becoming an animal rights activist and new vegan. And so while they were kind of like these parallel paths, I will say that they crossed over often, because this was around the time that Forks Over Knives, the documentary, was coming out, and those kinds of things were and still are used by animal rights activists to convince people to eat vegan for health, right? It's like, well, mm-hmm. even if they don't care about the animals, if we can get them to eat fewer animals, that's still good for the animals. And so learning about nutrition, being a really passionate animal rights activist, and seeing all of this sensational stuff come out about the health impact of eating plant-based, that kind of got mixed up for me, and looking back, very clearly was disordered for me, and what I had been doing myself at some points, and then what I was promoting as well. And I think a lot of folks, you know, this might resonate, kind of going in and out of maybe like that plant-based sphere and mm-hmm. really focusing on like health and disease prevention. And it can be really extreme a lot of the time, and it really has nothing to do with animal rights. It's really rooted in this like extreme fear of, you know, getting heart disease or getting diabetes or having to lose a lot of weight. And so as I progressed and grew and learned professionally and personally, I was able to see, you know, what was so problematic about that, both for myself and the way that I was, you know, talking about it and engaging with others about it.
Yeah, that's really important to be able to be aware and reflect on everything that it's rooted in for you and how you're portraying your opinions on it and your facts on it. And I think that that's very humbling to hear that, you know, you've reevaluated it from time to time, which is something I think, you know, we all could do more. I think if we're feeling like we're plateaued as a vegan, like, I don't know, bored with it or just forgetting why you've done it. I think it's always important to continually reevaluate. Why is it that we do this?
Yes, I think that is so important. Absolutely. And whenever I have vegan clients, you know, that's something I make sure that we spend a lot of time talking about in session is, you know, what got you interested in this lifestyle at first? You know, what is it about now for you? Like, how has that journey looked? And because I'm a registered dietitian and I do focus on like disordered eating type of stuff for a lot of the vegans that I see, it did get entangled with disordered eating at one point or another for them. And that's really common. And I do think it's important for us to kind of check in with ourselves because look at the world around us. Of course, diet culture is everywhere, but then especially within the vegan space, it's really murky. You know, we have a lot of animal rights activism, but then there's also this like no oil, no salt, whole foods, plant-based
right.
propaganda floating around at the same time. And it can get really easy to get sucked into that in a harmful way.
Yes. And I'm curious too, as a registered dietitian, did you see in your studies, like during school, did you see a lot of conflict with a plant-based or vegan diet with the medical professionals? Is that something you ran into where you were faced with conflict with that, a confrontation with that? Was it hard to justify to yourself or to others being in the medical field and saying, this is what I do believe to be the best way to live?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it's so interesting. So from an academic standpoint, I'll say no. And I definitely make sure to do my research and have like my talking points in my back pocket before I challenged anything in class, mm-hmm. whether it was to a professor or to another student in terms of animal products being required or overstating the health benefits of them or whatnot. But for the most part, you know, there's always like this small caveat, like, oh, I am vegan, supplement with vitamin B12. Like, you don't learn a ton about it. You just learn like a little bit about it, which is a problem because unless you really study it on your own, you can't believe that like anyone who has like an RD credentials is going to be able to help you with vegan nutrition. You know, that's like a subspecialty that you have to pursue on your own. And so it's disappointing. It's not really included very well in the curriculum. There's a lot more to it than just making sure you're getting your B12. So from that perspective, there wasn't any ever rhetoric like this is harmful and bad and no one should do it. I didn't encounter that. I definitely know that there are health professionals out there who do believe that from what I've heard that my clients are saying that their health professionals have told them and other experiences I've heard of and had myself. But I will say that it does require a little bit of manually, I don't know if I want to say manual cognitive dissonance on your part, but you know, I had to memorize all like the anatomy of an egg and the nutrition properties of an egg and different cuts, quote unquote cuts of like cows for beef and pigs for pork. Mm. And like, that was so sad. Like I would go home and cry, you know, and I'm like, well, I have to be tested on this and I have to perform well, you know, I have to get a good GPA so I can get into the next step in my career and training. And so that part was hard. But for me, I think because anytime I challenged anyone, because I was prepared with research or information, that I was never really like shut down or challenged back too difficult, like, you know, too intensely. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I have seen folks, and I think this is more on social media, who just throw around a lot of misinformation about vegan health and nutrition and just get totally pummeled by lots of meat eaters, and rightfully so, because they're saying stuff that just isn't true, which is another issue I take with the whole like plant-based thing, because it's very easy to poke holes in that. Like, I personally believe being 100% vegan, like the only reason that really makes sense for that is if it's rooted in like your ethics, you know, if it is a mm-hmm. social justice cause for you. So I know that was a really long-winded answer, but it was tough. And you know, I had to do clinical rotations in a hospital and work in food service. And luckily, I didn't have to prepare really any animal foods and any sort of taste testing I was able to opt out of, any animal labs I was able to opt out of in university. I wrote a blog post about this, I think last year, about like, if you're vegan and want to become a registered dietitian, kind of like, here's what the steps look like, and here's what the experience was like for me, and here's things you might want to consider. So if anyone is like thinking about going down that path or is just curious, I did write about it. But again, it was just my experience, and I know it's different for everyone.
No, that's great. I think that's a really awesome resource for people to have, and not just from a professional standpoint, but from a personal standpoint. I was very curious if that was something that was more challenging as you got into it, since it was kind of paralleled with a personal choice going vegan while you were on a professional path. And how, yeah, I think that makes sense though, because I think when you first start out, you are very passionate. Typically, most of us are very passionate once we find out what's going on and the curtain is lifted and whatnot. So I think that that makes sense that you were extra prepared, you were extra conscious of everything you wanted to talk about with it.
Yeah, and I will say, I think trying to be as calm and patient and compassionate as you can when folks do have questions, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like, where to get your protein? It's like, oh my gosh, biggest eye roll ever, right? But some people genuinely don't know. And so trying to talk about legumes, you know, like beans and lentils and tofu and peanuts and things like that. And I remember in grad school when I was with like a smaller cohort of people, you know, I was the only vegan. I think I was only vegan in my undergrad too, but you know, they got to see what I ate and they asked questions about it. And they saw like, you know, the amount of abundance that I lived with, and that it was like, oh, okay. Like you can be like happy and healthy and all of these things and be vegan. Mm-hmm. And I think also knowing that I wasn't it for ethical reasons and like wasn't on a restrictive diet while I was here and there, separate yeah. story. I think that really helped people see like, okay, yeah, like this isn't some big, extreme, crazy thing. They're just eating a vegan version of mac and cheese while I'm eating a dairy version of mac and cheese, you know?
Right. Yes. All of that combined, I mean, I'm sure that put you on awareness for your mental health. And is that kind of when you planted the seed of knowing that you wanted to help with coaching, helping people with mental health as well?
Yeah, that came a little bit later. I think because I was still very much in that space of like, I love the medical kind of part of dietetics. I really wanted to work in a hospital. I thought it was really cool to be able to, you know, calculate tube feedings and parenteral nutrition, which is where you get nutrition through an IV in your arm for, you know, different disease states and folks who are in the hospital. I thought it was so cool to learn about, you know, complex cases, and you get to look at the medical record and see like all this cool stuff going on, but not be the doctor. Like I thought it was like a cool way to still be involved. And to be honest, like I was really afraid of counseling and being a private practice dietitian because my education was very, very science heavy. I didn't have a single class in counseling. And so that again was kind of like a skill I had to pursue on my own. And I slowly built up my own counseling business on the side of my day job until I quit my day job and then, you know, launched my private practice full time. But I think that I was just dealing with some insecurities about my skills because it is very different sitting down with someone for an hour and counseling them versus calculating a tube feeding, and maybe they're on a ventilator and aren't even going to talk to you, or if you do talk to someone, it's for like 5 quick minutes in the hospital, right? And so
right.
I think that part came later, and definitely as I learned more about eating disorders and disordered eating and intuitive eating and health at every size, that came later for me. And so it really wasn't until that point that I was able to kind of see how the social justice aspect of weight discrimination really overlapped with, you know, the social justice aspect of animal liberation.
You mentioned it briefly for a second here, so I kind of want to dive into this a little bit. Do you have any tips for new vegans who are trying to meet those nutritional needs?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I like to say is to, rather than like eliminating all animal foods from your diet, think about substituting them. So rather than just taking things away from your plate, think of how you're going to substitute them. And there's a few different categories to think of that in. Protein is probably the most obvious one, right? If you're not eating meat, you know, what are you going to substitute instead? And for plant protein, the best way to go is through legumes. And that's just an umbrella category, which includes beans, lentils, peanuts, and anything made out of soybeans, like tofu or tempeh, or like a soy-based plant meat, and then peas. And the reason for that is because they're rich in protein, but they're also rich in the amino acid lysine, which other plant foods are lacking in. So, like, yes, you can get some protein from seitan, which is made from wheat, but wheat doesn't have very much lysine like beans do. And so beans are a really great, important staple to have for anyone who's vegan, to make sure that you're eating plenty of beans every day. A good rule of thumb to aim for is 2 cups a day, which might seem like a lot, but remember, tofu, tempeh, soy-based plant meats fit in there, as well as soy milk. And so that's one thing. I definitely see folks eliminating animal protein and then not making sure they're adding in enough plant protein. And some people might be like, wait, I hear that Americans eat way too much protein anyway, and we don't really need to worry about it. And it's just something, you know, that like meat eaters like to say that like vegans don't get enough protein. It's like, well, if you don't want them to say that anymore, if you don't want that to be true, just make sure that you're eating your beans and lentils and tofu, because it does matter. So substituting on that area. And then the other one is with milk. If you were previously like using milk as your big source of calcium, just to make sure that you're replacing it with a plant milk that is fortified with calcium. They're not all fortified with calcium, so you have to check the back of the label, the nutrition facts, and the ingredients to make sure that there's calcium added to it. You can also not really do that and take a calcium supplement, which is something that I work on with folks and talk about, like, where do you want to focus on food and where do you want to focus on supplements? There's no right or wrong. It's just, you know, some people prefer not to think too much about nutrition or feel like they're micromanaging their food and like, oh, I have to eat this to make sure I get enough of that. They'd rather just, you know, take some supplements and have that peace of mind, which is totally fine. You know, I just want to make sure folks are informed and getting what they need.
Yeah.
So yeah, so those two things are important from a nutrition standpoint. And then also from, I guess you could call it just like an enjoyment standpoint, or like restriction and not feel restricted, is to, you know, replace all of those fun foods like donuts, pizza, ice cream, french fries, you know, whatever it is, like still have all those things. And then for the things that aren't vegan, just find the vegan version of them, which for some folks may be more difficult depending on, you know, the resources that they have available to them. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how many options are available now, even in, you know, small towns, even in like regular grocery stores that aren't necessarily like a health food store.
It's true. And like being vegan, and I'm not sure how long ago it was for you when you went, but for me being vegan like over 10 years ago, it's like things have really changed. And it's kind of amazing to be able to see in different cities like how advanced we are and how far we've come with substitutes and or just alternative versions of things. And then you still go back to I go back to a smaller town and I realize like, oh, they're just now maybe getting non-dairy cheeses on the shelf. And it's a process, but it's cool to see that there are some of those resources available in a lot of places.
Yeah, it's so cool. I also went vegan just a little over 10 years ago, and I remember it was like just like tofu-y American slices, which were nasty. Sorry, tofu-y. Yeah. I love so many of your other products, but not your American slices. And like, you know, just like regular silk soy milk.
Yeah.
And Gardein, and like Boca Chicken, Gardein wasn't even out yet. And Daya mm-hmm. wasn't out yet. And I remember mm-hmm. when Gardein came out, I was like, this is insane. Like, this is so meaty. Like, they're chicken scallopini. And then when Daya came out, that was huge. And now it's like there's a million versions of everything. And it's so incredible. And that's only been 10 years. Like, that's so, so amazing.
It is. Yeah. I remember I had to drive like 45 minutes to an hour to find a place that would even have tempeh and vegan cheese, and the only vegan cheese that was out at the time was a different version, the earlier version of Follow Your Heart. And I remember, I think it was a mozzarella, and I think I used it in like a vegan lasagna that I made at home. And so that was like my whole thing, was like that experimenting with making my own vegan alternatives to things, but with like such limited resources. And I just look back on that time really fondly, but also like, wow, we've come so far in just a decade.
Yep. Yeah, that is so funny. Because you're from a small town in Illinois, right?
I am, yeah. Yeah. And like the coffee shops now, they offer coconut milk and almond milk. And I think they offer something else too, maybe soy milk. But it's just amazing to me because when I was in high school, my whole life, I didn't really like cheese. And I think I always had more of a lactose intolerance than I knew, because when I went vegan, I actually completely lost the enzymes. I am like permanently lactose intolerant now, like, which I mean is good because I'm ultimately vegan, but at the time I was like, oh my gosh, I guess I can't eat dairy anymore. And when I would try, it was just like, it didn't work. Which is fascinating to me that like, yeah, if you don't do that for long enough, you can lose that. And like, we never really had it in the first place, I don't think. I think, you know, we made our bodies become accustomed to being able to process lactase enzymes and things like that. I don't know. I just, I don't know all the science behind it, but I just know that, like, I used to eat dairy and now I definitely can't, even if I wanted to. But
yeah.
But yeah, I am from a small town in the Midwest, in Illinois, and it's just cool to see that they have some options now. Like I said, they're coming out with, I think there's like one grocery store in my hometown, and then there's a Walmart grocery. And so the grocery store has some non-dairy cheeses, and they might have tofu. And I think they have some of the frozen Amy's products, but I think they're the vegetarian versions. So they're making their way to being more inclusive, which is cool. And I still travel the 20 to 40 minutes outside, where it's a little bit more branched out, to get the main staples whenever I go home. But the cool thing is, my sister owns a vegan restaurant, so she's like an hour and a half from where most of my family lives. And so like, when I'm on the way home from Denver, I'm able to stop there and get some vegan grub.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Now I'm curious about like the parallel between you and your sister. I'm sure maybe you've talked about that before, and maybe that's for another podcast episode, but is so cool to have a sister who owns a vegan restaurant.
Right. Yeah. And she, oh man, I don't know exactly how many years she's been vegan, but she was vegetarian before that. And she's got a really cool story. I might see if she wants to be on the podcast sometime to just talk about being a vegan restaurant owner. But she's got just like so much passion for veganism, and is also vegan like me. And then my younger sister, our younger sister, is vegetarian, and she's been vegetarian, oh my gosh, probably longer than both of us have been vegan or vegetarian. So, and my mother is like mostly vegetarian, but basically pescatarian, if you want to put a label on it. So I mean, it's really cool that like we can all get together and have really no squabbles with what to eat when we hang out.
Yeah, so. That is amazing. That's so cool.
And speaking of like people who are inclusive and understand, you know, I feel really grateful that my family, like, I don't know, that they're really inclusive about, you know, the different kinds of vegan foods that are available. I would say my older sister eats a lot more plant-based, vegan, but plant-based, and she'll indulge in some things every now and then. And my younger sister kind of, she goes more with intuitive eating, and I definitely feel like I follow that as well. But there's not really a lot of discrimination at the table. If we want something more indulgent, we can all agree on that usually, and nobody really harasses each other. And it's just, it takes a while to get there, but I don't know, it feels nice. It feels nice that I know when I have to go back home, it's pretty good civil environment.
Yeah, that is really awesome. And obviously a lot of folks don't have that, so it's really cool to hear.
Right. Do you want to touch on intuitive eating for those who don't really know the term, or mindful eating?
Yeah, totally. So intuitive eating is this really cool framework. It was developed almost 30 years ago now by two registered dietitians. And it is basically like the antidote to like dieting and like weight loss, all of that like crazy stuff. And so it's like, well, if you're not on a diet, then what? You know, what does that even look like? And so the cool thing is like, most all of us are like born intuitive eaters, unless, you know, there's a health condition going on. But if you think of like little kids and babies, like they know when they're hungry, right? Like they cry and they throw a fit, and then you give them food and they calm down. And then when they're full, they turn their head away or they throw their food. Like it's very obvious, right? Like they're very clear, intuitive eaters, which is so cool. And so we're all born that way. Like we're hardwired that way. And it makes sense. Like when you think about like our biology and physiology, and then evolutionarily too, like it just makes sense like to keep us alive and happy and healthy. But then when we see as kids grow up and turn into teenagers and adults that, you know, we're conditioned, of course, by our culture to learn that, you know, certain bodies are good and certain bodies are bad, and you have to restrict your eating to make your body look a certain way or whatever it is. Like, those are all things that we learn, kind of like we learn to harm animals, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
When you think of little kids, like, they love animals. And, like, we're probably all familiar either with ourselves or, like, watching little kids who, like, when they first learn, like, where, like, meat on their plate comes from, they're, like, totally freaked out. And I've seen a lot of little kids who go through, like, phases of, like, wanting to be vegetarian because they're like, wait, that's effed up. Like, I don't want to eat chickens. Like, I don't get it. Which is also another, like, cool parallel between thinking about these two concepts. So intuitive eating, it's a framework. So when it was first formed, it was based on research about, like, starvation and kids eating and lots of different things like that. But now that it's been out for a few decades, it's had over like 100 research studies published on it, which is really cool. So we can see like how it actually works and how it actually benefits people's physical and mental health. Mm-hmm. So there's 10 principles to this framework, and it's all about, you know, making peace with food, giving yourself unconditional permission to eat all foods, listening to your hunger and fullness, enjoying food, like finding the satisfaction with food. And then there's like a little part about, they call it joyful movement, like exercising in a way that feels good and that's enjoyable, not to, you know, burn calories or get shredded and like tone your body, like focusing on.
I love that phrase. I love that. What is it? Joyful expression?
Joyful movement.
Joyful movement. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so cool. Obviously, like a lot of folks in the fat positive community do a lot of joyful movement stuff, which is great. And smashing those stereotypes about like fat people not being able to be fit or fat people don't exercise. And it's like, screw you. Like, yes, we do. Right. If we want to.
Or like if you exercise, it means you must be doing it to lose weight. And it's just like, no, it's just to move my body.
Yep. And then the last principle, the 10th principle, is called gentle nutrition. And so it's how to honor your health through this like very gentle, compassionate form of nutrition that isn't based in like fear and fear of weight, fear of dying of heart disease tomorrow if I eat this one thing. So it's like a very delicate balance of taking some, you know, health information and some nutrition information and incorporating that into your self-care around food and still being able to eat what feels good, eat what tastes good, and eat in a way that's going to support your health if that's what you want. And I think that's a part for folks who just like hear the term intuitive eating or maybe just learn a little bit about it, don't quite understand. They think it's like, oh, eat whatever you want, whenever you want, and just like go on a binging spree and eat like 37 donuts every day. And it's like, no, that's not what it means. They say it's a dynamic interplay between instinct, emotion, and thought, which I love talking about because I think a lot of people think it just means it's all instinct, which it's not. It's instinct plus your emotions, plus your thought. And that's where I like to think of like the gentle nutrition part coming in, or that like logical brain to help you make choices of like, okay, if I eat this amount of this thing, I'm probably going to get a stomach ache, so I'm only going to have this much. You know, that's like a self-care decision versus like, I can only have this much because if I eat more than that, that's too many calories and then I'm going to get fat and that's bad. And so it's helping folks think about food in a way that is honoring their internal selves and without focusing so much on appearance and weight and, you know, just all the crazy messaging out in the world.
Right. Well, because the opposite of intuitive eating would just be, you wouldn't be listening to what your body wants or needs necessarily. You would maybe just be counting. And that's, I just don't think that that's, you know, enough to go on.
Right. Yeah. And for honestly, for most people, because like counting and dieting and, or, you know, counting calories or points or macros, whatever it is, mm-hmm. for a lot of people, like that's really hard to maintain, and it's not your fault. Like biologically, like we're just not meant to like deal with food in that way. And so like folks go through this extreme swing between like restricting and counting and then binging and feeling out of control. And it just, it keeps them locked in this cycle of like shame and self-punishment and self-loathing. And it's really sad, but I think, you know, most of us have probably been there at some point in our lives just because of the world that we live in. So I think a lot of people can understand like what that feels like. Mm-hmm. And so intuitive eating is a really cool way to like get out of that cycle.
Yeah. And so, yeah, basically the lesson here is don't just go by what you think that definition is. When you see intuitive eating, maybe do some research on that and know what it means for you.
Yeah.
That's awesome that you explained it a little bit more in detail and how many studies there must be on it. It sounds like there's a lot of great resources out there. Well, and one of them is one of yours. You've got a free guide available in your link tree, right?
Yeah, yeah. I have one specifically for vegans, like how to eat intuitively as a vegan, because that's like a question I get all the time, because folks are like, wait, isn't, if you're vegan, then you're restricting animal foods. Isn't that a diet? And it's like, well, if you're an ethical vegan, like you don't really see those quote unquote foods as food.
As
like
an option.
Right. It's like not even an option for me. And I try to equate it sometimes to like keeping kosher for Jewish people, or halal, you know, for Muslim people, mm-hmm. or, you know, like a lot of people in America think it's wrong to eat dogs. And so is it like not eating dogs? Is that like restrictive for a typical meat eater? No, it's just that doesn't align with their values, right? So like I try to help people understand. And then that kind of launches into a whole other conversation about like the cultural construct of eating animals in the first place. Right. But yeah, so, you know, it can be helpful to think of it in that way. And then, of course, there are a lot of folks who are feeling a little mixed up between their ethics and maybe some disordered eating going on with veganism. And it can be really hard, and people can carry some shame for that if they feel like being vegan is what they feel is right to do, you know, from a justice lens, but that it is hurting their relationship with food and kind of keeping them locked in a disordered place. And so for those people, it's so important to really get help from some eating disorder, you know, healthcare practitioners to help you sort that out. And, you know, I like to tell people like veganism will always be there, and you're going to be able to help the most animals if you prioritize your health first, so that you can then, you know, be a long-term, happy, healthy vegan. And so for some people in eating disorder treatment, they might need to eat some animal things to, like, heal their relationship with food. And, you know, that's their thing. And, you know, that shouldn't be shameful for them. Like, that's a health concern. And that is allowing them to then go back to veganism in a healthy way. So I know it's a little tangent, but I did want to throw that out there because I know that there are folks struggling. And that's not to say that you can't heal at all being 100% vegan the whole time. That's totally possible too. It's just such an individualized thing.
Very much so. And a lot of that relates to self-care and ties into looking out for yourself. So just to segue here, like speaking of self-care, I mean, I love that you're a blogger. I think that it's great that as a professional, you still take the time to express your personal opinions on your professional endeavors. And you've got a few blogs highlighted in your link tree, such as the 40 Ideas for Quarantine Self-Care. And in that, you categorize them into sections like calming self-care ideas, energizing self-care ideas, and some self-care moods. And I just love that. And you also stress that routine is important, which I do agree with. And I guess I'm just curious, what does your self-care routine look like? Or what's your kind of mood go-to for self-care?
Oh, yeah. So I think self-care needs to be super individualized and really flexible. And, you know, as we're recording, we're still in quarantine here with COVID-19. And so for a lot of folks, self-care is going to look a little bit different now. And that's good, because the world, you know, looks different now. Yeah. We need to kind of pivot, you know, and check in with ourselves and say, okay, am I getting enough here? Am I getting enough here? Where do I need to, you know, boost things up in that area? So for me, thinking of still in kind of like a COVID brain, sleep has always been super important to me. Mm-hmm. I've always been a person who needs a lot of sleep, and I've prioritize that, which sometimes gets in the way with like social endeavors when the world is open, of course, when you're like out late and doing stuff. So I'm a big sleeper. Like if I don't get enough sleep, that just has like a negative domino effect on everything else the next day. So sleep is really important for me. And then also just like moving my body in some way, even if it's just doing like a few different kind of like stretchy yoga poses, just helping my body feel a little bit looser. I do work at a desk pretty much all day long, and I have terrible posture, and like I'm slumping over all the time, and I usually have a cat on me, and I'm like sitting in a weird position. So for me, really taking care, especially as I get older, of my physical body with like stretching is just so important. And you know, getting fresh air and pumping my blood outside if I can. I don't feel super safe doing that because I live in a city, and it's really hard to stay 6 feet away from people, and most people still aren't wearing masks, so that's that's frustrating.
Yes.
And then I'm a huge fan of therapy, of psychotherapy. So I see my therapist every week. We're seeing each other over video now. That's really huge for me. And I am just like a huge promoter of therapy to everyone. If you haven't tried it, give it a try. If you tried it before, hate it, try someone else. I sound like a drug pusher right now. I swear, like, therapy is so awesome. And I just wish everyone had like a safe space to just share what's going on for them and have someone hold space for that, you know, without judgment or expecting anything.
Totally.
It's not even like they're going to tell you what to do, you know, it's just a space to share your stuff, and maybe they'll help you make sense of what's going on for you. But that can be so, so helpful for lots of things.
Right. And there are some like free apps you can look at for maybe just like a digital texting style therapy session. Or if you have the means, like a real live therapist is obviously like an amazing opportunity to just feel heard and feel validated. And I do think it's worth mentioning, like, you know, your roommate or your partner is not always the person you should vent to about everything. You know, it's always good to have even just like a friend to vent to about certain things, like feeling stifled in your own self-isolation situation or what have you. But I love that you're such an advocate for therapy, because it's something that America doesn't really embrace as often as it should.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. There's so much stigma around mental health in general. So I think the more people that talk about going to therapy, taking medications for mental health concerns or mental illnesses, like just normalizing all of that. You know, how many people out there are on statins? You know, it's like, that's normal. Like, shouldn't some help for mental health be normal as well? I mean, the world is a tough place. And so I think the more we normalize it, the more accessible we make it, you know, the more people can get the help that they need.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else on your mind that you want to talk about today?
I don't think so. We covered so much stuff. It's been really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we dived into a few key things here that I know that you are a big advocate for, and that the Chubb Club definitely aligns with. And I think it's going to be super helpful for people to hear about. If you want to follow Taylor for more, she's on Instagram, and you have a website, taylorwolfram.com.
Yep.
And you have a lot of resources there. So I guess I'll just say thank you so much for making the time to do this. And I know that people are going to get a lot out of it. And I'm just so excited that we had a chance to hear from you.
Yay, me too. Thanks so much, Miranda.
And we'll talk to you all soon in the Chubb Club. Have a good day, everybody. Hey there, my chubby vegan friends. Hungry for more? Well, if you're looking to learn some new dishes to make while stuck in quarantine, you can catch me, Miranda, on Zoom this coming Sunday, May 17th.
the Vegan Chub Club is happy to partner with Northwest Veg, a nonprofit organization that is bringing the fun into your kitchen. Come make vegan sushi burritos with me at 2 p.m. Pacific or 5 p.m. Eastern Time. More info on our Instagram, or you can find the link to register in this episode's description. Be sure to follow us at Vegan Chub Club on Twitter, at The Vegan Chub Club on Instagram, and be sure to join the Facebook group to share your story and let us know if you are interested in being a podcast guest. Yes, you. Follow Taylor at Taylor Wolfram RD and Miranda at Uprooted Foodie on Instagram. Talk to you next week.